the whole investigation an immediate and razor-sharp focus. Every week, Norris would initiate a conference call with Randall in Manhattan and Berryman in Southern California to discuss what they were digging up, where it might lead, and what the next steps might be. Soccer may not have been a big deal in the U.S., but all three were aware of how closely it was scrutinized in the rest of the world. With so many potential targets living overseas, the slightest peep about what they were doing could severely damage the case. They had to be absolutely confident about their plan for Blazer. Norris wasn't a die-hard fan like Berryman, and in fact didn't even own a television, to the amusement of his peers. But he did follow Tottenham Hotspur, a team that seemed perennially doomed to fall just below the top ranks of English soccer. Early on Saturday and Sunday mornings, when English Premier League games were shown in the U.S., he'd call Berryman to chat about the case, knowing the agent would be up before sunrise, glued to his television. In short order, the two had grown close, recognizing in each other a deep appreciation for the craft of building a case. They bounced ideas off one another and delighted in sharing new discoveries in the increasingly Byzantine investigation. In his career, Berryman could think of only one or two other prosecutors who understood him as well as Norris. And Norris, eager to keep chatting with Berryman late into the night, would sometimes call him from inside the bathroom of his cramped Brooklyn apartment to avoid waking his sleeping wife and young children. In one of their calls, Berryman suggested a code name that they could use as shorthand to refer to the investigation. Something like ABSCAM, the FBI's name for a public corruption sting in the late 1970s, or Operation Silver Shovel, which brought down a ton of politicians in Chicago in the 1990s. Berryman's idea, which he said came to him in a flash, was Operation Own Goal. He liked the idea that crooked soccer officials had brought defeat on themselves due to their corrupt ways, just as a soccer player might accidentally put the ball into his own net. Norris rejected the notion out of hand, leaving no opening for debate. The soccer case would have no name. The 58-story Trump Tower, with its jagged steel and black glass exterior, shares its midtown Manhattan block with the only slightly less imposing IBM building. The two skyscrapers were completed within months of each other in the early 1980s, and are connected at ground level by an enclosed glass atrium built under an incentive system that allows developers to exceed zoning restrictions in exchange for incorporating public spaces into their projects. In contrast to the chaotic and profoundly glitzy lobby of the Trump Tower, swathed entirely in garish pink Breccia Pernice marble that a New York Times critic once said gives off a glow of happy, if self-satisfied, affluence, the adjoining atrium presents an oasis of peace and tranquility. With light gray granite floors and tall stands of bamboo, the 8,000-square-foot space is uncluttered and calm, devoid of the constant noise and commercial bravado that permeate its next-door neighbor. Businessmen come to find moments of respite from the bustle of the city. Tourists rest and eat sandwiches, and schoolchildren frequently cluster beneath its tall glass roof to hear afternoon concerts. The plants and airy open space baffle the sounds of the city, and at the right angle can even block out the tall buildings all around, creating a small island for quiet reflection. On the evening of November 30th, 2011, Randall and Berryman walked into the atrium together, took a seat at a small round table near the entrance, and waited. The day was winding down, and only a few other people, scattered around the tables, remained. An hour earlier, Randall had called Chuck Blazer to say he'd like to talk again. Blazer had been at dinner, but said he'd be glad to meet later if he didn't mind the trip uptown. The two agents, dressed in suits, arrived together and peered through the atrium's glass walls, watching intently for their target. Finally, a van pulled over near the atrium's entrance on 56th Street, and the driver unloaded a scooter, which Blazer then mounted and navigated through the doorway. Berryman tried not to stare. Somehow, the many photos of the soccer executive on the internet had failed to do justice to the physical scale of the man. He seemed larger and hairier in real life, and he smiled amiably through his shaggy beard as he wheeled over to the agents. Randall greeted Blazer familiarly, though not warmly, shaking his hand. As you may know, We're investigating corruption in soccer, Randall said. This is Steve, and he'll tell you what we're doing. Berryman reached out and gave Blazer his business card, which clearly identified him as an agent of the Internal Revenue Service. He paused to let Blazer look it over, before he delivered a speech he had rehearsed several times in his mind. My name is Steve Berryman, and I want you to know that I'm doing this case for the right reasons, he began. I love football. It's in my blood. And I want to do something to clean up all this corruption. I have been working on foreign corruption and money laundering cases, and I am going to be successful at this. He paused for a moment, looked at Blazer seriously, and said, You haven't filed taxes for years. Berryman explained to Blazer that he had traced his accounts and had found evidence of more than a half dozen sources of income, totaling millions of dollars that had never been reported to the IRS. In addition, Berryman said, he knew that Blazer had foreign bank accounts, which he had never disclosed. That was illegal under the Bank Secrecy Act, which required taxpayers to report the existence of such accounts to the federal government. Altogether, Berryman said, the evidence they'd found painted a clear picture of tax evasion, a felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison for each year that a return was not willfully filed. The statute of limitations was 6 years, which meant Blazer faced a maximum of 30 years behind bars for his tax crimes alone. Then, to punctuate his speech, Berryman handed Blazer a subpoena. It was an unusual move pulled straight from Berryman's bag of investigative tricks, compelling the recipient to turn over information about all foreign bank accounts he or she held. Normally, under the Fifth Amendment, individuals are protected from providing potentially self-incriminating information. But such Title 31 subpoenas, Berryman knew, wiggle right through a useful loophole to put the person targeted by the subpoena in a rather awkward spot. Either hand over documents that could be used to build a criminal case against them, or face being held in contempt of court. Berryman gave Blazer a moment to look over the subpoena, then concluded, We want your help, he said. And then both agents stared intently at Blazer. It was a critical moment, and they had discussed it endlessly with Norris and Hector in recent weeks. Busting Chuck Blazer for tax evasion was fine, but that wasn't really the goal. They could have just arrested him on the spot and dragged him away in handcuffs, but a standalone tax case would get them nowhere. They wanted Blazer to cooperate, to trade his knowledge and access for a chance at a reduced sentence. This Trump Tower confrontation was their big play, and Blazer had a clear choice. If he went for it, then there were a million ways the case might go. He could open up the entire soccer world to them. But if Blazer refused, then they would have little choice but to prosecute him right away and potentially never get his help. They'd have to charge him and arraign him in open court, and the whole world would know what they had been up to. The stakes were incredibly high. At first, Blazer said nothing, sitting in stunned silence. Then he let out a long, slow sigh, and Berryman could feel a warm tingling sensation in his gut. I want to help, Blazer said. His girlfriend, former soap opera actress Mary Lynn Blanks, had been begging him to come clean for some time, he explained. She'd told him over and over he had to deal with it. This has been weighing on me, my tax situation. I want to fix it and set it right, Blazer said, a pained look on his face. Corruption in soccer, he added, has gone on for far too long and it needs to stop. Berryman and Randall glanced at each other, restraining smiles, and told Blazer he was making the right choice. He'd need a lawyer, they said, who should get in touch with the prosecution as soon as possible. Berryman took back his business card and wrote Evan Norris's phone number on the back. Returning it, he told Blazer he couldn't tell anyone other than his lawyers about this. Then he and Randall said goodnight and departed, leaving Blazer alone amid all the bamboo. It was a cool early winter night, but not cold. When the two agents had arrived at Trump Tower several hours earlier, Fifth Avenue had been crowded with cheerful families on their way to the annual Christmas tree lighting ceremony held just a few blocks away at Rockefeller Center that same evening. Now the Midtown streets were deserted. It was pretty late, but Berryman couldn't wait to share the good news. He called Norris on his cell phone, a grin on his lips. Blazer, he said, had flipped. Big things were sure to come soon. 3 days later, Blazer wheeled into the offices of Friedman, Kaplan, Seiler, and Edelman, a boutique litigation firm located on the 28th floor of an office tower just off Times Square. After his encounter with the agents, Blazer had first reached out to his personal attorney, Stuart Friedman, a subdued, bookish man who advised him on commercial matters and had some experience in commercial sports law. Friedman wanted to help, but he was not a criminal lawyer, so he had made the referral and accompanied Blazer to the meeting. To reduce the risk that somebody might spot Blazer, who, after all, cut a rather noticeable figure, walking into a law firm, the attorneys agreed to meet early that Saturday morning, when there was little traffic in Times Square, and he could pop out of a car and through the building's revolving doors without drawing attention. Friedman introduced him to his new white-collar defense attorneys, Mary Mulligan and Eric Korngold. Mulligan had been a federal prosecutor in New York's Southern District and taught classes on criminal law. Korngold had also been a federal prosecutor, but in the Eastern District, where the FIFA case was being run, and was later a deputy attorney general for New York State. Gathered around a conference table, the lawyers carefully explained what it meant to cooperate with a federal investigation. The prosecution's goal was simple: to expand the case, gathering enough evidence to charge additional people with crimes. Norris and Hector believed Blazer could help them do that. If he decided to go through with it, Blazer would have to tell the prosecutors everything he knew. He'd have to share documents, emails, text messages, financial records, photographs, anything they asked for. Blazer would also most likely be asked to do things to help the case. He'd have to make calls and secretly record the conversations, send and receive emails, and meet people while wearing a wire. Eventually, he would probably have to testify against friends and colleagues in open court, talking about their deeds while they glared at him. He would, in other words, become a snitch. But in the jargon of law enforcement, it all fell under the umbrella of providing substantial assistance. And the reward for substantial assistance, for doing exactly as asked, for spilling his guts, for leading a secret life, for betraying his friends, and for helping secure their convictions, was leniency. First, Blazer would participate in a long series of meetings with the prosecutors, called proffers, and they'd hear his story. After he had given everything he could, and convinced the feds he'd been honest, Blazer would have to plead guilty to one or more crimes. There was no avoiding that. He'd almost certainly be forced to pay a large fine. In exchange, he'd be rewarded with a cooperation agreement, which promised Blazer that, when it was time for a sentencing, the prosecutors would write a letter asking the judge for a downward departure from sentencing guidelines. That translated to, "Please go easy on this guy because he was helpful." With any luck, it might be possible for Blazer to avoid prison entirely. It wouldn't be cheap, but he'd be able to live in his own home, and since his cooperation would be a secret, nobody in his social circle would have to know he had been busted, at least until the case became public. In fact, they absolutely should not ever learn about what he was up to, because talking about cooperating was forbidden. If Blazer babbled, or lied, or did anything to interfere with the case, all deals were off. He could be arrested, locked up, or forced to plead to additional crimes, including obstruction of justice. Cooperation, in other words, would be like a really terrible unpaid second job that Blazer couldn't tell anyone about. He would spend untold hours with prosecutors and special agents, and he'd be at their beck and call. He'd need permission to travel. And since a crucial part of cooperation was being available as a witness at trial, his sentencing wouldn't come until every other potential defendant had either been convicted or acquitted. The whole process could take years, during which time the feds more or less would own Blazer. The alternatives were simple, but far more perilous: plead not guilty and fight the charges in court, which could lead to a long prison term if Blazer was convicted, or agree to plead guilty but refuse to cooperate, abandoning any hope of calls for moderation from the prosecutors. Blazer stood firm. He wanted to cooperate. His lawyers would reach out to Norris and set up an initial meeting. But first, they needed to understand how their new client had come to this place. so Blazer started to tell the story of his life in soccer. By the time he had finished, it was dark and cold outside, and 9 hours had passed. Chapter 12. The Crown Jewel. Chuck Blazer liked to take credit for creating the Gold Cup, CONCACAF's marquee tournament, which pitted the region's national teams against one another. Dreaming it up and getting it off the ground were, in fact, his first major accomplishments as the Confederation's general secretary. But the part of the story he tended not to dwell on was how the event was initially a commercial disaster and was saved only thanks to the efforts of a little-known but ingenious Brazilian soccer marketer. That man was named José Ávila, and he had a special talent for taking struggling third-rate tournaments and turning them into huge moneymakers. The first Gold Cup was held in 1991, and initial commercial interest in the event was almost non-existent. Chuck Blazer had envisioned the tournament as a profit center for both CONCACAF and himself, thanks to his unusual contract, but he struggled to attract sponsors and was barely able to command any money at all trying to sell the TV rights to broadcasters, cable channels, or pay-per-view. Selling commercial rights to soccer matches, particularly in a country where the sport ranked fifth in popularity behind football, basketball, baseball, and hockey, was significantly harder than it looked. Still, Blazer had seen how lucrative events like the World Cup and the European Championship could be, and realized he could use some advice. He had first met Ávila in 1987, when Blazer, then commissioner of the American Soccer League, was looking for investors to buy additional franchises. Retired Brazilian star player Carlos Alberto Torres introduced him to Ávila, who flew up to New York from Sao Paulo, and spent 2 days in Blazer's home office in Scarsdale, assessing the league's prospects. In the end, the Brazilian opted against buying a team. But in anticipation of the 1994 World Cup in the U.S., he moved to Boca Raton for 2 years, starting in 1992 to get a feel for the American market, which he believed held tremendous commercial potential thanks to the country's large and growing Hispanic population. Blazer bumped into Ávila at the second Gold Cup in 1993, which he decided to split between the U.S. and Mexico in what ultimately proved to be an unsuccessful attempt at ginning up more interest from potential sponsors. Spotting the Brazilian in a VIP box during a match, Blazer seized upon the opportunity to ask his advice. 3 years earlier, Ávila had co-founded the sports marketing firm Inter Forever Sports in Miami, and he'd started scooping up inexpensive rights to club team matches in Central America and the Caribbean, as well as the occasional one-off friendly exhibition match featuring national teams flown into South Florida. Most of the revenue from such events came from ticket sales and from pay-per-view contracts from restaurants and bars that catered to a Hispanic clientele. Ávila told Blazer to forget about Mexico, which might be soccer mad, but presented numerous logistical challenges. Instead, he said, the Gold Cup should be hosted only in the U.S., the world's richest country, where maximum revenue and minimal organizational challenges presented themselves. Handled correctly, the tournament could be a big success. But, Ávila said, the best course of action would be for CONCACAF to sell the Gold Cup's broadcasting and commercial rights to a marketing firm with expertise and contacts in the business, rather than Blazer trying to do everything himself. In fact, Ávila added, he might be interested in buying the rights. And he ultimately did just that, signing a contract in October 1994 to pay the Confederation $9.75 million for the next 3 editions. When that deal expired, Ávila signed on for 2 more tournaments, and the tournament steadily grew in both prestige and revenue. When Blazer, eager to boost his 10% commissions, decided to take the sale of CONCACAF's rights in-house in 2003, refusing to renew with Ávila, the Brazilian felt slightly betrayed. He had taken an essentially lifeless tournament that couldn't even be seen on cable television and turned it into a reliable moneymaker drawing multinational sponsors. And now that it was self-sustaining, Blazer was taking it away. But Ávila took the news in stride. For the most part, he busied himself with his much larger business in South America, where his primary company, Traffic, was based, and where he had been a pioneer in the field, building a sports marketing empire and making him a very wealthy man. He had helped the Gold Cup grow in value and prominence, but the quality of play was still fairly low, and soccer fans in North America seemed far more interested in watching tournaments from other parts of the world, featuring the planet's best players. And it just so happened that Avila had, for more than 15 years, controlled the rights to one of those tournaments, the Copa America, which was packed with stars from Brazil and Argentina, two of the greatest soccer nations in the world. Losing the Gold Cup was disappointing, but Avila wasn't overly concerned. So long as he had the Copa America, his crown jewel, he would continue to be, as Brazilian soccer legend Tostão once called him, the owner of the entire soccer world. When José Avila was an eager young sports reporter, clutching a hulking microphone and transmitter and racing up and down the sidelines of second division Brazilian soccer matches in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the business of soccer was a simple affair. Teams sold tickets and stadium owners rented space on a few billboards to local businesses, as well as charging radio stations to use a soundproof press booth and bring in equipment. There was no concept of an exclusive broadcaster, and for important contests, a half dozen or more radio stations might compete for listeners. Enterprising journalists like Avila not only had to rattle off 90 minutes of play-by-play during matches, provide analysis at halftime, and interview players after the match, they also were responsible for selling advertising. There was no sales staff and no producers. In those days, the reporters did everything. The energetic Avila was good at all of that. And to draw a larger audience and thus more advertising, he developed a distinctive persona. He decided to go by only his first initial, J. And by the time he was 20, he had moved to Sao Paulo from the remote agricultural town where he grew up. Soon, J, which was pronounced Jota, had made a name for himself, and by the late 1970s was running the sports department at TV Globo, Brazil's most important broadcaster. But after being fired for supporting a strike by sports journalists, Avila decided he wanted more financial security. And in 1980, he bought Traffic Acessoria e Comunicóis, a small Sao Paulo company that sold bus stop advertising. By then, Avila had spent more than 20 years in soccer and had become consumed with the idea that the sport, from a business perspective, was a poorly run farce. Brazil was the greatest force the sport had ever known, winner of 3 World Cups, and its fans were monomaniacal, thinking of little else but their teams. Yet the country's professional clubs were perpetually saddled with huge debts. The leagues were crippled by poor organization and infighting, and the vaunted national team barely had enough money to pay for its own uniforms. Improving technology meant that it was increasingly easy for people around the world to watch the Brazilian national team, known as the Seleção at home. Yet little was done to exploit that demand. When selling bus ads didn't turn out to be very profitable, Avila decided to test his theories about sports marketing. In 1982, Traffic signed its first deal with the Brazilian Football Confederation, known by its Portuguese acronym CBF, giving him exclusive rights to sell advertising space inside stadiums where the national team played. Soon, Traffic was branching into various aspects of Brazilian sports, buying the rights to promote Brazil's professional volleyball league, for example, or signing a deal to overhaul the sports department at broadcaster Sistema Brasileiro de Televisão. Traffic's big breakthrough, however, came in 1986, when Avila met Nicolas Leos, the newly elected president of the FIFA-based confederation that oversaw South American soccer, known as CONMEBOL. The two men got along, and sensing an opportunity, Avila asked about buying the rights to the Copa America. One of soccer's oldest tournaments, predating even the World Cup, the Copa America was created in 1916, when Argentina's foreign ministry invited Chile, Uruguay, and Brazil to meet in a competition in honor of the 100th anniversary of Argentina's independence. The event proved so popular that a Uruguayan journalist in attendance proposed forming an institution to regularly organize the tournament. And the world's first regional soccer confederation was born. The tournament eventually fell into neglect. the most recent three editions prior to 1986, had been organized as round-robin tournaments with no fixed host, were largely ignored by soccer fans, and generated less than $25,000 for CONMEBOL. As far as Laos was concerned, the Copa America was a dog. But Avila had a vision. The tournament would be held in a single host country on a rotating basis, and he would oversee almost every aspect of running it for a lump sum paid to the Confederation in advance. Traffic would offer a cash prize to the winner to motivate national federations to field their best players, and the sports marketing company would keep 100% of the proceeds from sponsorship, licensing, advertising, television, and radio. CONMEBOL, like most soccer federations at the time, didn't have much cash. Laos, a lawyer and former president of Paraguay's Soccer Confederation, was delighted to let a third party pay to manage the thing, and on October 3, 1986, sold Traffic the rights to the 1987 edition, to be held in Argentina for $1.7 million. That first tournament was poorly organized and badly attended, and lost Traffic money. Nonetheless, Avila snapped up the rights to the 1989 and 1991 Copa America tournaments for a total of $3.9 million, and over time the event turned into a huge commercial success. Avila had correctly anticipated an explosion in television money for the tournament, and had pushed hard to ensure the biggest stars from each country played in every edition. With interest in South American superstars booming and cable television becoming ubiquitous, networks and sponsors around the world began clamoring for a piece of the Copa America. By the late 1990s, Traffic was fending off entreaties from sponsors willing to pay millions of dollars for each edition. And in the run-up to the 2011 edition, it was selling television rights to the tournament in 199 different countries. The huge profits helped Avila expand into a wide range of other soccer rights deals, including youth competitions, World Cup qualifiers, and the popular Copa Libertadores tournament, which pitted Latin America's best pro teams against one another every year. Closer to home, Avila bought rights to the Brasileirão, Brazil's top professional soccer league, brokered sponsorship deals for the Brazilian national team with Pepsi, Coca-Cola, Umbro, and Nike, and bought his own professional clubs in Brazil and Portugal while creating an entire second division professional league in the United States, the North American Soccer League, named after the long-defunct league that shuttered in 1985. Avila, the grandchild of impoverished Lebanese immigrants, grew enormously wealthy and bought several television stations, a pair of newspapers, and a production company in Brazil. He opened a soccer academy for promising youth and managed the contractual and publicity rights to dozens of professional soccer players around the world. He owned farms near his hometown, had numerous houses in Brazil and one in South Florida, and, of course, owned fleets of luxury cars, including, briefly, a $400,000 Bentley. Bald and bespectacled, Avila played lots of golf, had a share in a company that gave him use of a private jet, and appeared on Brazil's society pages along with his wife and three children, the eldest of whom married a Vogue cover model. Glossy business magazines called on him at his opulent Sao Paulo offices to write glowing profiles, and he proudly told reporters his life story. "I'm daring," he boasted to one journalist. "You have to know how to take risks." But what Avila never mentioned in those interviews was the true price he had to pay for all of his success, the ugly reality of the modern soccer business that he played a fundamental role in creating. All of it was based on bribes. At least as far back as 1991, every Copa America deal included side payments. At first, the president of CONMEBOL, Laos, began demanding money before he would sign the rights contracts. Then the presidents of the Argentine and Brazilian soccer associations threatened to keep their best and most popular players out of the tournament unless they got cash as well. And the bribes didn't stop there. What started relatively small as a few $100,000 paid once every few years had become enormous, with millions of dollars going to soccer officials every year to ensure Traffic continued to receive the commercial rights it needed, as well as the superstar players required to make the tournament a commercial success. After a few years, Blazer and Warner too began demanding money on the side in exchange for Gold Cup rights. One payment, for example, of $200,000, was wired through an intermediary with a shell company that had a bank account in Uruguay in March 1999 to one of Blazer's accounts in the Caymans. Blazer then sent along half of that to Warner's accounts in Trinidad. Over time, these soccer politicians grew increasingly insistent, demanding more and more money with each new contract. It got to the point that Avila had to hire full-time intermediaries using phony consulting contracts so that he could make the payments while keeping them off Traffic's books. It didn't matter that Avila was the innovator, the one whose vision had turned the penniless, parochial world of Latin American soccer into a viable commercial enterprise, followed by fans around the world, or that his sales staff were the ones doing all the hard work of brokering all those sponsorship and television deals, while these petty sports dictators did nothing but enjoy a gold-plated lifestyle. Without the payments, the soccer officials simply wouldn't sign, and then everything would collapse. But as the commercial value of soccer skyrocketed, it became apparent that Avila wasn't the only one willing to go to great lengths to acquire those rights. Perhaps the first sign that Avila's empire was under attack had come in the spring of 2005, when the Honduras Soccer Federation informed Traffic it no longer wished to do business with the company. Over the years, Traffic had locked up the broadcast rights to World Cup qualifiers for every soccer federation in Central America, as well as Canada and the entire Caribbean Football Union. The contracts weren't by any means gigantic, $1 million or $2 at most, but thanks to the large numbers of Central American expatriates living in the U.S., those rights could pay off handsomely when one of the national teams went far in World Cup qualifying. And they were particularly valuable when those teams played against Mexico or the U.S., matches with very large prospective audiences. Traffic had inked its first deal with the Federación Nacional Autónoma de Fútbol de Honduras back in 1997, and had renewed or extended the agreement several times since then. The federation's refusal to sign again in 2005 mystified Avila's Miami employees, who believed they had a contractual right of first refusal, and the dispute ended up in court. The lawsuit revealed that a rival sports marketing company, Media World, had been trying to break into the World Cup qualifiers niche, and advised by a former Traffic employee who knew exactly how Avila kept soccer officials happy, had been secretly meeting with the Honduras Federation for months. The litigation proved unsuccessful, and Media World retained the rights. Still, to Avila and his staff, losing a pipsqueak like Honduras didn't feel tragic, and nobody got too exercised when competitors soon snatched away qualifier rights for El Salvador and Guatemala as well. It wasn't until the 2010 World Cup in South Africa that Avila realized he had a full-fledged crisis on his hands. Most of FIFA's top officials were lodged at the five-star Michelangelo Hotel in Johannesburg during the tournament. In a series of meetings, first with Nicolas Leos, and then with a number of other South American soccer officials, Avila was informed that he was losing his contract for the Copa America, and that instead the rights were going to be assigned to an Argentine sports marketing firm called Full Play. The news was shocking. As far as Avila was concerned, he had a valid contract, signed 9 years earlier, giving him rights to the 2011 and 2015 editions of the tournament, as well as the first option to purchase the 2019, 2023, and 2027 editions as well. He had agreed to pay CONMEBOL $46 million for the deal, and had generously bribed several officials, including Leos, who alone got $1 million to ensure they signed the deal. Yet apparently, it hadn't been enough. In one meeting at the Michelangelo, the head of Ecuador's soccer federation told Avila that he was losing the Copa America because he had bribed only the top three CONMEBOL officials, and not every single president of every single South American federation. The previous year, the Ecuadorian explained, 6 of the 10 members of the confederation, none of whom had received Copa America bribes from Avila, had formed a unified bloc they called the Grupo de los Seis, the Group of Six. They then used the threat of their majority vote within the Confederation to push Leos for a piece of the action on a number of CONMEBOL deals. One of them was the Copa America. "The contract is ours," Avila had protested. "You cannot come in and just tear up a valid contract and sign another contract with another company for the same product." "I can," the Ecuadorian replied, "and I've already done that." Avila's crown jewel was being stolen. For decades, the presidents of the soccer associations from South America's two economic and athletic powerhouses, Argentina and Brazil, along with Nicolás Leos, the CONMEBOL president, had exercised total control of the sport in the region. TRAFIC negotiated its Copa América deals exclusively with those three officials and paid bribes only to them. The rest of the continent, Ecuador, Paraguay, Peru, Chile, Colombia, Uruguay, Bolivia, and Venezuela, were mere afterthoughts. With little, if any, political power, the officials of those federations received none of the special benefits that were whispered about at congresses and in stadium luxury boxes. Full Play's owners, a father and son team named Hugo and Mariano Hinkes, offered to change that system. They had been slowly breaking into the South American rights business over a period of years, snapping up World Cup qualifiers from a few of the continent's smaller countries, and now were angling for bigger prizes. Starting with Ecuador, the Hinkeses built close relationships with the presidents of nearly every one of the marginalized South American soccer associations. They hosted the officials at their vacation houses in Uruguay, plied them with pricey concert tickets, gourmet food and wine, and other gifts, and one by one convinced them they had been getting a raw deal and could do much better working with Full Play. The message clearly resonated. Only the presidents from Uruguay and Chile seemed uninterested. Why, the Hinkeses asked, was it fair for Julio Grondona, president of the Argentine Football Association, and Ricardo Teixeira, president of the Brazilian Football Confederation, to get what must be huge bribes from TRAFIC in exchange for the Copa America rights, while the Confederation's other top officials got nothing? Didn't Paraguay play in that tournament as well? Or Colombia? Those countries may not have won the World Cup, but could the Copa America be played without them? On the other hand, the Hinkeses said, if they signed with Full Play, each president would get $1 million under the table. That message spoke very clearly to the officials and emboldened them. They pledged to ensure Full Play would get the tournament. But not quite yet. Since sponsorships and television rights for the 2011 edition of the Copa America had already been sold off, it would have been almost impossible for another firm to come in and take control of the tournament on such short notice. So TRAFIC still organized that year's edition. Following the World Cup, both CONMEBOL and Full Play had made multiple public denials that they had a formal deal, and Avila used the 2011 tournament, held in Argentina, as an opportunity to make a last-ditch in-person effort to salvage his rights to the 2015 and 2019 editions. He'd heard rumors about the bribes that Full Play was offering, as well as the above-the-board price the firm would pay CONMEBOL for the rights themselves, and he met with one federation president after another, desperately offering to match any competing payments. The president of the Venezuelan Federation, Rafael Esquivel, used his encounter with Avila to complain that he hadn't made enough from the prior edition of the Copa America, which was held in his home country. According to Esquivel, TRAFIC had promised him a $1.5 million kickback from the sale of domestic television rights, yet he'd received only $500,000. Venezuela was consistently one of the weakest teams in South America, the only country in the Confederation to have never qualified for a World Cup. The oil-rich nation was far more enthusiastic about baseball than soccer, and Avila normally would have laughed off Esquivel's demand for more money. But given his current plight, the Brazilian felt he couldn't afford to say no. He grudgingly obliged, using a series of intermediaries to wire Esquivel $1 million in late July. It was in vain. Despite the public denials, CONMEBOL and Full Play had in fact secretly signed a contract for the Copa America more than a year earlier at the World Cup. And even as he was cheekily demanding a kickback from Avila in Argentina, Esquivel had joined the presidents of every other South American soccer federation, as well as Leos, in signing a letter formally confirming that deal. Attorneys hired by Avila eventually sent cease and desist letters to Full Play and CONMEBOL, and when those accomplished nothing, traffic sued. The civil complaint, filed in Miami-Dade County Court on November 21, 2011, alleged willful, flagrant, and deliberate breach of contract. Full Play, the Brazilian firm said, had conspired to take over the activities of CONMEBOL. On December 1, 2011, Mariano Hincas wired $450,000 from one of Full Play's accounts, number 7063420 at a Zurich branch of Bank Hapoalim, through a correspondent account held at Citibank in New York, and finally into Banco Citibank S.A., account number 000045010200177, in the name of Lexani Advisors, Inc., in Panama City. The owner of Lexani Advisors, a soccer marketing consultant named Miguel Trujillo, subsequently used the Panama account, as well as a Banco Citibank account number 000045010200082 in the name of Spawn Sports S.A., which he also controlled, to wire a $250,000 bribe to Honduran Alfredo Howitt, as well as $100,000 apiece to two other Central American soccer officials. The payments had been agreed upon several weeks earlier in the Uruguayan resort town of Punta del Este, where Full Play's owners, Hugo and Mariano Hincas, had entertained Howitt and the other Central Americans for several days, all expenses paid. The Hincases had flown the officials to Punta del Este on a private jet to talk to them about the possibility of Full Play acquiring the commercial rights to the Gold Cup from CONCACAF, as well as World Cup qualifying matches for several Central American countries, and eventually handling all of the Confederation's properties. Since Jack Warner's departure, Howitt had served as the interim president of CONCACAF, and in theory was well-placed to decide how to allocate rights to its most valuable properties. Amid all the tumult at the Confederation, Hugo Hincas and his son perceived a great opportunity to acquire rights to a major CONCACAF event. The U.S. and Mexico were highly valuable commercial marketplaces, and the Gold Cup, the Hincases believed, could be hugely profitable if handled properly. Over lunch in Punta del Este, Mariano Hincas made a proposal not unlike the one Full Play made to the Group of Six roughly 2 years earlier. For too long, Central America had been marginalized in CONCACAF by Chuck Blazer, Jack Warner, and their impenetrable Caribbean bloc. Those two men had controlled everything and reaped all the spoils. But Honduras had played in two World Cups and looked to have a good shot at playing again in 2014. The Central Americans had more than paid their dues, and with Howitt now atop the Federation, it was their turn. Wasn't it well past time they got a piece of the action too? Yes, Howitt agreed, in exchange for a few well-placed dollars here or there, passed through a convenient intermediary in order to avoid any suspicions, he and his friends would be delighted to help out their new friends. In fact, he said, there was a CONCACAF executive committee meeting coming up in Miami in mid-January. That would be a perfect time to propose that the Confederation start doing business with Full Play. But first, of course, Howitt and his two associates needed to see the money. Chapter 13. Queen for a Day. FBI launches investigation into World Cup Dirty Tricks campaign. Investigators from the FBI have interviewed members of England's failed 2018 World Cup bid as part of an investigation by the American Law Enforcement Agency into alleged corruption, Telegraph Sport can reveal. The article, published December 7, 2011, was full of details about the soccer investigation that were supposed to be secret, certainly not splashed across the pages of a London broadsheet. It noted that American law enforcement had met with members of the English bid in November, that they were investigating possible foul play associated with World Cup voting, as well as the events that had occurred in Port of Spain, and that one of the potential crimes was CFU delegates taking the cash they had been given into the U.S. without properly declaring it. It said the authorities were examining payments to Chuck Blazer, and that FBI agents had been meeting with FIFA's head of security, Chris Eaton. Then, a week later, the Telegraph published a second article, confirming that Blazer had been questioned by FBI officials and that the investigation is being handled by financial specialists based in New York, who have powers to access bank accounts and track financial transactions. For Evan Norris and Amanda Hector, the prosecutors working the case, the two articles were highly aggravating. They were investigating an international organization. Possible targets were spread all over the world. Leaks could jeopardize the whole thing. Warned of a probe, corrupt FIFA officials could hide or destroy evidence, move assets, threaten possible witnesses, or even retreat to countries that don't have extradition treaties with the U.S. The case was now formally before a federal grand jury, which gave the prosecutors the power to issue subpoenas, but also tightly bound them not to disclose anything non-public about it. If either of them violated grand jury secrecy, they could be prosecuted for criminal contempt, and they had formally notified the agents on the case that they, too, had to keep things absolutely quiet. They'd already had a problem with details of the case appearing in the media back in August, when Andrew Jennings and the Reuters reporter published stories revealing that the FBI, and specifically the Eurasian Crime Unit, was in possession of documents pertaining to Chuck Blazer. If the investigation was going to go any further, and now that they had Blazer in hand, it certainly was, this kind of thing had to immediately stop. Norris got the whole team together, looping in the IRS's Steve Berryman on a conference line. Norris was, by nature, a reasoned and careful man. He liked to listen, but volunteered little when he spoke, and valued the benefits of patience and restraint. On first impression, he could seem flat and devoid of emotion, but those who knew him learned that he could express very powerful feelings with just a slight narrowing of his brown eyes. Addressing the team, he tried to balance the seriousness of the leak with a measure of rationality, calmly citing concerns about information getting out and trying to figure out who on the small team to hold responsible. But nobody was willing to cop to such an impropriety. Perhaps there was another explanation. Perhaps nobody on the team had leaked. In order to conduct formal interviews with the English BID officials, American investigators had been obliged to get permission from British law enforcement, and several members of a metropolitan police unit dedicated to organized crime had tagged along to the meetings. The UK was both obsessed with soccer and possessed a highly aggressive press that was deeply sourced in law enforcement. The Telegraph reporters had been covering the World Cup bidding story for some time and had broken numerous big stories on the topic. Barring any other evidence, the most likely explanation, Norris decided, was that someone from Scotland Yard had been the source of the leak. There was no way to be sure, and it would be pointless to try to get the Brits to confess. But the newspaper story made clear that despite soccer's low profile in the U.S., it was a gigantic deal in the rest of the world, and it would be hard to keep a lid on any operations they undertook abroad. So Norris delivered a new mandate. They would stop working with foreign law enforcement entirely. No conducting interviews abroad, no requesting records from foreign governments or overseas banks, and absolutely no more talking to the press. Andrew Jennings, helpful though he might be, was out. There was no question that all those restrictions were, in some ways, going to make the case trickier to develop. Considering how many meetings, tournaments, and other soccer events took place outside the borders of the United States, and how many of the potential targets weren't American, it was as if they were intentionally tying their hands behind their backs. But they would just have to get creative and figure out different ways to gather evidence. Secrecy was paramount. The case was going dark. Chuck Blazer was queen for a day. It was December 29th, a Thursday, and cold, with temperatures in Brooklyn hovering right around freezing. Blazer settled into a conference room in the United States Attorney's Office overlooking Cadman Plaza. Blazer had been caught in a crime, a serious and easy-to-prove felony, and his goal was to trade useful information for a better deal down the road. First, however, Norris spoke. Although he was nearly as tall as Blazer, the prosecutor seemed almost comically slender, beside the hulking man, occupying just a fraction of the space at the table, swimming in his dark suit, while the soccer official threatened to burst out of his. Norris's face betrayed no emotion, other than a slight furrowing of his thick eyebrows, as he stared at Blazer and calmly explained what exactly was about to happen. If there had been any confusion about who was in charge, it immediately dissipated. This was a proffer session. Blazer was not being offered a plea deal or immunity of any kind. Instead, Norris assured Blazer that any information he provided, including indications of any crimes he himself had committed, would not be held against him in court. The prosecution would simply use whatever he told them as leads to hunt down evidence of other crimes by others. Although that protection did not extend beyond what was said that day in that room, it meant that for the moment, Blazer could freely share without fearing it would leave him in worse shape. Criminal attorneys snidely called proffer sessions Queen for a Day meetings, after the 1950s and 1960s game show by the same name, in which four down-on-their-luck women would be interviewed by host Jack Bailey about their hardships. After they were all done, the studio audience would vote with applause on whose sob story was most heart-wrenching, and the winner would be wrapped in velvet robes, crowned, seated on a throne, given four dozen roses, and showered with gifts, inevitably breaking into tears. This, then, was Blazer's chance to be Queen Chuck. Unless, of course, he lied. Or told anyone else he was cooperating. Or got caught holding back. Or came up with some other creative way to hold up the investigation. If Blazer misbehaved, then the prosecutors were free to dredge up every crime he mentioned and use them directly against him. The prosecutors would ask the questions, and Blazer would answer. They wouldn't reveal who else they might be talking to or where the investigation was going, and, Norris suggested, Blazer should refrain from even trying to guess. They wouldn't even tell him what crimes they felt they could charge him for. They would test him. They would see if they could catch him in lies. They would compare what he said to what they already knew. No promises whatsoever would be made. A proffer was a one-way street. Of course, everything would be very professional. This was a federal case, not some good cop, bad cop routine in a two-bit precinct house. There was no yelling, no two-way mirror mounted on a grimy cinder block wall opposite a steel table. The conversation was not being secretly recorded. The stone-faced FBI agents in the room weren't there to interrogate, threaten, or cajole. They were there to quietly take handwritten notes. Prosecutors sometimes jokingly referred to the agents as scribes, and after it was over, to type them up into an official memorandum for the case file. That was the deal. If it didn't seem fair, that's because it most certainly was not. But for Blazer, it represented the first step toward earning the cooperation agreement he coveted, his chance at avoiding a long prison term. And it started with him signing the document Norris slid across the table. Proffer letters vary widely among the country's 94 judicial districts. Some are a little softer, offer a tiny bit of wiggle room for the defendant, or give them a bit more protection should things go south. But the Eastern District of New York has one of the toughest, least generous letters anywhere, with terms that very much favor the prosecution. "This is not a cooperation agreement," it read. "The office makes no representation about the likelihood that any such agreement will be reached in connection with this proffer." Blazer signed. He would sign a similar agreement at each additional proffer session he attended, 19 in all, spread over the next 2 years. The main offices of Fedwire and Chips were just a few minutes' walk from each other in Lower Manhattan, and after sending so many subpoenas to them over the past several months, Berryman thought it was well past time to go visit in person. The IRS agent found himself in New York constantly, as the case progressed, staying in a government-rate hotel downtown, and working out of either the FBI field office, which he found stuffy and noisy, or his hotel room. Given the distance from home, Berryman often stayed for several weeks at a time, far from his wife back in California. In January 2012, he was in New York again to attend Blazer's initial proffers, and took time one day to visit Chips, which was a private company owned and operated by a consortium of banks. Berryman hit it off with the general counsel, and as they chatted, It occurred to him that the rest of the team would benefit from gaining a better understanding of how tracing worked. So he asked the lawyer if he wouldn't mind getting together with a few other agents and a prosecutor or two to explain to them the kind of information they could get through subpoenaing the system. Within a few days, Berryman had set up meetings at both CHIPS and Fedwire, and convinced Norris, Hector, and the FBI's Jared Randall to come along. The first meeting was at government-owned Fedwire, housed within the Federal Reserve Bank of New York building on Liberty Street. The building, opened in 1924 and modeled after a Medici palace, is a kind of fortress, occupying an entire city block, and its basement vault contains the world's largest deposits of gold bullion, some 17.7 million pounds of the shiny stuff at the time of the meeting. High above all that wealth, the team working the soccer case watched a presentation about how money moved in an electronic and almost instantaneous era. More expensive for banks to use than chips because of the way it accounted for transactions and the speed with which it conducts them. Fedwire was the smaller domestic service. Nonetheless, it had originated 127 million wire transfers in 2011, moving $664 billion among the more than 9,000 banks around the world with which it worked. That meant that the names, addresses, and account numbers associated with hundreds of millions of wire transfers were just a subpoena away. Money laundering was a very modern crime, apt for a globalized age of international commerce. Anyone could commit murder, but only the wealthy and powerful had the resources required to move ill-gotten capital through complicated webs of companies created at their behest by expensive lawyers. Almost by definition, money laundering deprived governments of taxes that could be used to the benefit of law-abiding citizens, and it helped obscure the frequently serious crimes that generated the money in the first place. Yet despite the gravity of the offense, money launderers typically operated with the impunity that comes with great privilege, unable to believe that they could ever be touched. To Berryman, it was fascinating. Hunting down money launderers was, to his mind, the most exciting thing happening in law enforcement. The U.S. government had busted huge money laundering operations in recent years, ranging from narcos in Mexico washing drug profits through money exchanges and New York banks, to Russian oligarchs using remote South Pacific islands to clean up their plunder. Those cases barely scratched the surface of a giant global industry dedicated to hiding dirty money. The soccer investigation was an excellent case in point. FIFA officials taking bribes needed to hide that income since it couldn't be justified, and they frequently used shell companies and tax havens and phony service contracts in order to make the fruit of their crimes disappear. Fans of the sport, meanwhile, were left helplessly bemoaning what had become an open secret. The sport was dirty from top to bottom. The people's game had become the property of selfish men pretending to be some species of public servant while hiding countless millions of dollars in far-flung corners of the world. It had been that way for years, if not decades, and nobody had been able to do a thing about it, despite widespread accusations of corruption. But that, Berryman thought to himself, was because nobody had ever had the combination of desire, knowledge, and opportunity to take it on. After the meeting, Berryman chatted excitedly with the rest of the team, happy to see they were beginning to understand the incredible power Fedwire and CHIPS represented for a big international investigation like this one. But not everyone seemed so impressed. "Good job, Steve," was all Randall said, before heading back to the FBI field office a dozen blocks uptown and skipping out on the second presentation at CHIPS. The cool response came as a surprise to Berryman, who assumed that his voracious appetite for information that could help the case would be shared by everyone else on the team. As soon as he had joined, Randall had passed Berryman a folder of documents related to corruption in soccer, and he had responded by regularly sharing articles on the topic on the assumption the FBI agent was as captivated by the topic as he was. Berryman knew that Randall had talked numerous times with Andrew Jennings, a formidable repository of information about the sport in his own right. He'd even listened in on one of Randall's calls with Jennings. And after reading Jennings's 2006 expose, Foul, documenting corruption within FIFA, and focusing in particular on Blatter and Warner, Berryman had bought copies of the book for Norris and Randall. The truth was that few people could match Berryman's enthusiasm for the torturously slow grind of money laundering investigations, and at the same time his degree of righteous indignation at the idea of people corrupting soccer. On a case with as much potential as this one, it went without saying that everyone would work long hours and make sacrifices.